I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Time is 1:04 p.m. We are in the Anchorage LIO main conference room. Members present, I represent Wilson, Guerra, Vice Chair Sadler, Representative Gaddis, Kawasaki, Representative Pruitt, myself, Co-Chair Newman. We do have Representative Steve Thompson and Representative Munoz in Juneau, I believe, and Representative Guttenberg and Edgman are online. We have to do a little bit.
Yeah,
it's on here. I guess we'll have to get a little closer, huh? How's that? Can everybody hear? Okay, let's get fine-tuned here. Let's take a break.
Take a break.
Ready. They got us. Well, let's start all over at the top and welcome to the House Finance Committee meeting. Today is Wednesday, May 6, 2005. Time is about 1:05 p.m. We are in the Anchorage LIO main conference room. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Vice Chair Sadler, Representative Gaddis, Kawasaki, Pruitt, and Co-Chair Newman. We do have online Representative Edgman, Guttenberg, and Munoz and Thompson. We have to do a little bit of housekeeping. We're first time in this facility, so I've been asked to make these announcements. So point out the emergency exits to those in attendance. There are two main doors and one in the back left corner. You see the main doors, the exit signs. All materials are online. The items will be added. We are broadcasting statewide on legislative TV, and so please ensure your cell phones are off, especially cell phones that were left up here on the table to get rid of that. Today we're going to have Pat Pitney back, the director of OMB. She's going to go through House Bill 1001, which is the governor's most recent proposal. Little history back, the House and the Senate both passed conference committee report for House Bill 72, the operating budget that has been transmitted to the governor's office waiting for action. The governor introduced House Bill 1001. With some additional requests for the budget, basically four different sections within that budget. One that we've referred to as some meat and potatoes type of programs, which is increases within the different departments, and we'll go through those. There is another section that has to do with education funding and union contracts and then Medicaid. We'll try and get through probably the first part. I think the intent is to do some of the Medicaid stuff next week. Representative Thompson is going to be working on that and his staff, so that'll probably be coming at us next week. I think today and tomorrow we'll be working on basically trying to talk to Pat Pitney and whoever she's got from different administrations. See, we have Commissioner Lupin here from DOT. She'll bring some other folks here, I'm sure, to try and make sure we're informed. And then on Friday, I think we'll have David Peel back up to discuss the finances of the state and where we're at and the fiscal situation of the state. So that's kind of the agenda for the week as far as we know right now. And it's been changing and it's been evolving as we go along, but we'll try and keep you informed the best we can. With that, we'll have Pat. Pat, can you come up? And we'll start at the beginning of House Bill 1001 and go through there. And we did this briefly last week down in Juneau. It is nice to be up here where we can see a different audience too and be able to talk to that. I know that we've all been out in our communities and talking to folks too, so it's always interesting to make sure we invite as many people or the public as we can to participate. there were some basic differences here that we had. And Pat, either I can go through those, or if you want to just go through them, we'll start at the top, again, with the Department of Education and Early Development. Basically, within that, there was restored. Does anybody else have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we get started, certainly, and I'm sorry to cut you off. I was just trying to get a question in before we got started. But before we get started, we've heard this presentation a time or two, and I know we haven't dug into it super deep. And I've had the opportunity to be back in my district and certainly have a lot of questions. So I think the first question I really have for Ms. Pitney, if you don't mind, and I think it may or may not direct where the conversation goes, but just for starters, last time we spoke, you'd indicated, Ms. Pitney, that this was a conversation starter and that it was to progress a conversation along at least what I thought I heard is to try to get to a CBR vote where we could pass a fully funded budget, and I believe that those were your words. So with that in mind, I would ask, do you have the authority from the minority to engage in conversation for a CBR vote? I mean, as we keep advancing forward, I'm trying to figure out, and this was the same conversation that we had last time, I don't understand how this advances it unless you and the minority are on the same page and you're helping them out. And I asked that question last time before.
Let's Pat, give that your best shot if you can.
Okay. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm Director for Office of Management and Budget for the Walker Administration. And through the chair, Representative Gaddis, the governor's office does not have the authority, permission, or anything for the ability to negotiate with the minority. It is going to be this body and the House majority and House minority that has that negotiation. The minority does not agree with this. We, both sides, are not happy with this starter dialogue. We call the Take Two budget. But right now we have a spending plan from this body that is $5 billion, and we have revenue of $2.2 billion to fund it. So we're facing, you know, at what date does government stop working with only $2.2 billion, or what things do we fund in lieu of others? So do we choose to put all the money into education on day one, and, you know, not fund health, not fund the legislative group, not fund the governor's office? Or do we put, or do we cover health and maybe a little bit of education on day one? So with a $5 billion spending plan and a $2 billion checkbook, and no permission to spend any other savings accounts, we're in a situation that requires action, and we're only here to start the dialogue because the action is required within this body and in agreement with the Senate.
And the authority for the appropriations relies within this legislative body, and there will be negotiations between the House majority, the minority, the governor's office, the Senate, as we move along between all of us and what we're going to be doing in this budget, whether we accept everything in this budget or nothing in this budget. This is a piece of legislation that will be presented to this committee just as any other piece of legislation is presented. I would like to recognize, too, we have Senator Diesel and Representative Josephson, Representative Devlin, Representative Chenault, and Representative Tilton in the audience, so welcome to our meeting.
Thank you,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just there it goes. But Ms. Pitney, the same question I want to ask you today, as I asked I think last Thursday, I just want to clarify: what is the governor's intention regarding HB 72? It's been transmitted to his office. Does he intend to hold it, sign it, line item veto it? Can you help us understand just the framework of what we're looking at here?
Well, at this time, House Bill 72 is in ballot. It has $5 billion of spending and $2 billion of revenue. The Executive Budget Act says you provide a budget that has spending and revenue that match. This does not match. If it's cured, then we have a valid piece of legislation. If it's cured with either somehow to get either a three-quarter vote or change levels, then it becomes a different story. But at this point, it's an invalid budget, and there is, we have time, a short period of time to correct that. But absent a correction, it's invalid.
May I comment on that? I don't know if I'd call it an invalid budget. The House and the Senate majorities passed a conference committee budget, passed those on the floor. There was opportunities for the minority to either approve a draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve or not. They decided to not. And then they had requests for additional funds to try and do that. The majority did not want to do that, did not want to add additional funds into the budget. And so now we're at a negotiating point.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, can I follow up my question, please?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. So just to clarify, can you hear me? Yes, good. So the governor will not sign SB 72, or he will under what conditions?
We are looking for a funded budget, and that's our goal.
So specifically, under what conditions will he sign SB 72?
I'm sorry, I cannot speak for him on that exact specifics. We are looking for a funded budget, and if it were a funded budget, then the answer becomes very different. Right now, it is a $2 billion revenue side with a $5 billion spend planned.
President Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I disagree with your notion, because we have in that bill that we would continue to pay for the rest of this fiscal year, which right now we're looking at potentially not having money, as well as pay it through to a portion of the next year. And I think it would really help us clarify, as we're looking at this take two, as you've termed it, whether or not we're having a discussion about the full budget, or we're just having a discussion about how we're funding it, or we're just having a discussion about these items that that the administration has put out there, as you've indicated, for the conversation starter. And I think that for myself, as well as the public, trying to understand what are we truly discussing, it's really hard to know, as long as that HB 72, which does have funding out there, it may not fund it fully, and you're correct, but it does have funding out there, it does have authorization to spend, both if through authorization through next year, as well as some money for next year, as well as the payment or the ability to pay through this year. So what I need to understand is, when should we expect from the governor either a veto or a signature on the current piece of legislation to help us understand what we're talking about fully? If we're just going to talk about the increase and trying to fund it, I think that's a different conversation than trying to figure out, are we concerned about what we spent money on, and the governor didn't like what we spent money on, and he's said, go ahead and start over again, or are we just talking about how to make sure that we fund it? We need some definitive answers from him in terms of either a signature or a veto. Should we expect that at any point in time soon, so that we can make sure that these meetings are as productive as possible?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. So based on the day that SB 72 was transmitted to the governor's office, he has the ability to sign it or veto it between now and the 19th of May. If it is a fully funded budget sometime before then, whether probably not even the 19th, sometime before then, if it's a fully funded budget, then it's accepted. But there's no way that he could set a precedent of accepting a two-fifths funded budget. So there's time to cure this with the CS that the House has with just changes and a revote, or some other mechanism. There's, you know, it's up to this body to figure out how to cure that, but it's in play. But it cannot go into law when it's two-fifths of a budget.
Can I follow up? Go ahead.
Representative Pruitt.
So I've heard you say that multiple times. It's about the funding. Then why add $90 million? It seems to me more like this is a conversation of I don't like your budget, less than just the funding discussion. The funding discussion, if that's the case, then we should only basically have one piece of paper here that says go to the CBR, find something else. And then, of course, because it's that type of a, because it is an appropriations bill, we can add, minus, we can do whatever we need to do as a legislative body.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like it's more than just that. It's also that the governor did not like what we handed to him, and he has chosen to add something to it. Why is that not where that's where part of the confusion started off to begin with. Why add more items to it? And is that what we should be having a conversation right here about? Is the items that you would like for us to look at, or is it back to the funding? And if that's the case, then that's really just a disagreement amongst legislative individuals. And I don't know if the governor sat down with both sides. I know the previous governor, I was in a room and we were talking about education funding, and he came in and sat down. It was very neutral, trying to get people to come to both sides. Maybe that's probably a better approach at this point in time. So what should we be discussing here?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the governor feels that the reductions that were made in the conference committee budget went too deep on a few items. And so as is his right, he asked, and because we don't have a fully funded budget, we said, please reconsider these items. We believe that the conference committee went too deep, and although it's $93 million, it's 1.4% different, and in total, it reduces operations for agencies by 8% from the previous year. So significantly deep cut. The governor accepted 90% of the cuts over and above his original cuts, which were $250 million, almost 6% of agency operating budgets, walking into it. So the governor and this administration understands the fiscal situation the state is in and believes that we have to reduce, and is committed to reducing in the future. It's the speed at which those reductions are made and the impact they would have on the economy and the services to citizens of the state. So these minor changes in this budget are commitments that the governor made in his original and made when he was came out with his original budget, so these are consistent with his priorities. So they can be considered, but the negotiation isn't between the governor and this body. The negotiation is between the legislature itself to get to a funding plan. And if it's a funded budget, you know, we kind of have to accept it. Our veto power is to reduce additional funding, not to add funding to a budget.
It's just a matter of how you want to get to the numbers. We have move down the line here. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pittman, let me just try and correct a couple of things. This budget is, people have said it's $90 million more than what passed the conference committee, but that doesn't seem accurate. It's $54 million more, but that's less than what the House majority passed, and then there's a $39 million transfer from one set of state funds to another. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes, it is correct.
Thank you. I heard a statement, and Mr. Chair, I heard a statement that someone had just add money to the budget. I will say for my caucus, we have offered substantial cuts to the budget that have not been accepted. And, of course, we have tried to get education funded and things like that, but it's unfair to say that one caucus has tried to add to the budget. Ms. Pitney, I guess I'm not one to criticize this, but my understanding is this is the governor's attempt to sort of kickstart both sides of the legislature to start working together to pass a budget so we don't have a shutdown. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, yes, with $10 billion in the constitutional budget reserve and for days like we're facing now, it's the conversation starter so we can have reasonable yet much reduced state operations, that it's orderly, and so that in the summer we can start a very open and transparent dialogue with the entire state about what our revenue options are going forward.
Thank you. Through the chair, one final question.
Representative Gere.
Thank you. And I think this is a point that that hopefully folks will be able to get across to the public. You can tell me if I'm wrong, Ms. Pitney, but we could fire every single trooper, correctional officer, state employee funded by unrestricted general fund money and still only cut roughly half the budget deficit. Regardless of which version of the budget we've seen, you know, people are wedded to $50 million here, and I understand that. But under any version of the budget we've seen so far, under current oil prices, this state is out of savings in the next 2 or 3 years. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the state would have consumed, if no other action is taken and oil prices stay at where they are today, the constitutional budget reserve would be exhausted in 3 years.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just say that I think it is time for us to work together and across party lines to get this job done.
Okay, thank you, Representative Garrett. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine goes a little bit on this conversation. So I understand you had two options. You can come back and ask us to add more things back into the budget for a conversation starter. But why wouldn't the conversation starter been, we need to get into these other funds to at least get closer to funding the budget? Why did you go into adding more in versus utilizing some of the other accounts that are available if we were given permission in the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the discussion on revenue is one that at the beginning of this session we said we would bring it to Alaskans on a very open and transparent, considered discussion, very orderly discussion. That discussion kickoff will be on starting in June 5th, 6th, and 7th. That's just the start. We anticipate many, many, many discussions across the state, across all groups, talking about what our options are. We were taking the lead of what was in Senate Bill 72, and in fact, with the exception of the few additions, all other language is exactly the same as SB 72. So we were trying to keep the particular legislation that we put forward to mirror as closely as possible with enough differences to get a conversation started. And so it was a choice to keep it down the road that had been discussed through the entire session.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, I think maybe she didn't understand my
Wilson.
Question. I'm talking about the $1.6 million approximately that are in all of the kinds of funds that are designated, whether it's the power cost equalization, the higher education fund, Alaska housing. There is $1.6 billion that is in separate funds that could have been utilized if it was been put into the bill. So my question is, instead of looking at what you could add into it, why did you not look at, you know, saying, you know, if you guys gave us permission for this, that would give us $1.6 billion. Mm-hmm. And then also, we would like these others, but here's some trade-offs to those so that we still are not increasing the budget. Because I went home this weekend, and I talked to everybody I could possibly talk to, and they think what we cut out of this budget is insufficient. They don't see them as deep cuts at all. And so, you know, I think there's a kind of a miscommunication between what maybe, you know, Juneau might think and what some of our districts think. But a big part is that the conversation started could have been, how do we fund the budget versus how do we add to the budget? So why was that not part of this budget that you gave, that 1.6 approximately that's sitting there, and then trade-offs versus just additions?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, again, the intent was to keep, the reason why was the legislation that we provided to restart the dialogue was to mirror all of the discussions that had happened and mirrored the exact legislation that is now sitting on the governor's desk for the revenue solution. So it was a matter of trying to be consistent with the action of the House and the Senate through the conference committee. The if it's the desire of the legislature to use that 1.6 and provide the administration the ability to utilize that $1.6 billion, that would be a start to the gap.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we just have the wrong person in front of us. Maybe the governor needs to be invited so we can get the straight answers. Thank you.
Jeez.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pitney, you're here as the governor's director of Office of Management and Budget, so you represent the governor to us, especially on matters of the budget. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes.
Outstanding. Thank you. You said that it's a question if the governor would sign HB 72, and you said yes if it were a fully funded budget, and that's correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes.
Great. I want to give you the opportunity to get on the record now specifically and comprehensively what the conditions are that would constitute a fully funded budget for the governor to sign HB 72.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that the revenue and expense match, and it's a full-year budget.
Okay. Does the specific level,
thank you.
Follow-up, sir. Does the specific level of funding for individual programs factor into that?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the appropriation responsibility and authority rests with the legislature. The message by the governor and the administration submitting the budget is we felt like there were some cuts that went too far and would damage certain programs in the state, but the reality is the appropriation authority and responsibility lies with the legislature, and the only opportunity the governor would have is to reduce, the only opportunity in a light item of veto is for the governor to reduce the funding provided.
Okay.
Representative,
thank you, Paul, sir. But again, the legislature did accept the governor's proposed budget, worked it through the committee process, worked through the conference committee, and did pass a level of spending. The governor has taken exception to that and has called a special session and given us an alternative budget that has increased levels of spending for programs.
Mm-hmm.
So you do acknowledge that the legislature has the appropriations authority, yet the governor has come back to us and added appropriations. Just want to make sure that I get that clear. So, and follow up, a good different question?
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. You said that the governor understands the deficit and the need to cut, just not now and just not if it affects people, I think is what I heard you say. So my question is, if not now, when? When does the governor intend to? Thank you. Speak more of the microphone. So, I've been accused of speaking too softly, so I'll speak louder now. So you said the governor wants to cut the budget, understands the deficit, but not now and not because, and because it would affect people. So my question is, I think it's Mamiety, is if not now, when? When does the governor plan to cut? Understanding that every dollar passed, in addition to what we have before us, has to be cut later in addition to more. So when does the governor intend to cut the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the governor in his FY16 original proposal cut nearly 6% out of all agency operating budgets, adding the $250 million cut from agency operations, plus the over $400 million cut from the capital budget. Nearly $800 million was reduced in the governor's original budget proposal to this body. That is a cut. So, and we believe that there's going to be further spending constraints as we go forward. So so this isn't the end. It's how fast we step down. We felt in the original budget proposal that we were jumping down three or four stairs in certain areas. The conference committee budget is more like jumping down two flights. We're just stepping back one or two stairs from those two flights on these adjustments. So the governor has cut. The governor agrees with nearly all of the cuts presented in the conference committee budget. And we plan to be working for reductions in fiscal year 17's budget. This isn't about cut. It's about when to stop cutting and how fast to cut when.
My question was, when will the governor cut? Understand, yes, the governor has proposed cuts in the budget. The legislature has cut the budget. My question is, when does the governor intend to cut back the increases you're proposing now, and when do you propose to do the additional increases, the reductions? Is that FY17?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this administration is committed to additional reductions in fiscal year 17. There's adjustments and times to move into those reductions. Taking everything all at once is very hard organizationally, and we want to give a chance to take those reductions in a considerate and thoughtful manner. These are big reductions, bigger than any time in forever. These are massive changes that we have to put in place. We plan to do additional changes and reductions in 17, and it's just a matter of time.
And that's a direct question to the chair. Any questions for at the point right now, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Chair. A few things. Ms. Pitney, Representative Wilson, and I hope I didn't get it wrong, talked about you liquidating other funds, the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the Higher Education Fund. I personally don't think those are good policies, but if you liquidated the Power Cost Equalization Fund and the Higher Education Fund, we'd have no money for college and higher education and vocational education scholarships, and we'd have no money to help with high electrical costs in rural Alaska. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that is correct. And additionally, this administration would not advocate for that, and we would strongly advise against doing something like that. But again, it's the legislature's. It's the legislature's right. They make these appropriation decisions, and we would highly advise that that would be not in the best interest of state policy from the governor's perspective.
And that'd be a big call. Those are the purview of the legislature, if we want to go into those funds or not, or look at them and how they're used.
Finalized, Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And Ms. Pitney, obviously this is a special session on three subjects, but you've heard a lot about cuts, 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 and more cuts. But if you can't cut your way to a balanced budget and we run out of savings in 3 years and don't do anything about revenue, my view of the smartest thing to do on revenue is different than others. Mine is a fair share for oil. Others have different ideas. But if all we do is cut and you can't cut out of the deficit and you run out of savings in 3 years, what does that do to our bond rating?
So, you know, let's try and get a little bit more back into the budget here. And I've been pretty liberal in letting people kind of get things off their chest. I know everybody's got a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of tensions that have been going on. So I've allowed this to expand a little bit further than the discussion here. But, you know, I don't want to get into oil taxes and things like that. We are going to have some presentations by Ledge Finance on economics of the state, and we can ask questions there, I think, Representative Guerra. Pat, if you want to give it a shot, go ahead, but I'm not going to go very far down the line of changing tax. That's not what we're here for today.
Mr. Chair, I don't need more on oil tax. I just want to know if we what that does to our bond rating. That's all.
Ms. Pitney.
So the bond rating is made up of multiple considerations. What is
what are the current assets of your state? What are the resources in your state that can turn into assets? And what is the political stability of our state? And on the first two, when the administration went to New York to talk to people about our bond rating in January, we knew our annual revenue was low, but we knew our current assets were high, significantly high. It's credit to the legislature to have put aside the funding that we have to weather through some of these storms. We have tremendous resources in the ground. And we had at that point political stability. What is different today? We still have annual revenue that it's at risk due to oil prices. We still have tremendous assets in the bank. We still have tremendous resources in the ground. But at this point where we are looking at what could be a government shutdown in the really near future because of the political impasse, we no longer have the political stability. That could impact bond ratings well before 3 years from now, if indeed we didn't do anything proactively. Again, the governor is completely committed to addressing the state on the revenue question, putting it out there, letting people know what situation our state is in, letting people know that even at $90 a barrel oil, that if we ever got up there, $90 a barrel oil isn't going to change the revenue expense picture dramatically. Even at $90 a barrel, and now we're facing $66 a barrel oil.
Yeah, we understand that. But we did get information from Ledge Finance earlier that those questions were asked about bond ratings. And so I'm going to repeat a little bit of the answers there, and we're going to have further information on this later. But the bonding agencies, their biggest concern is this legislative body, this government, have the ability to turn this spending around and to get control of the spending. That was one of their highest priorities, to be able to do that, and I believe that was publicized in one of the things that the governor talked about, actually, if I remember correctly, that it was getting this budget under control and can reduce spending. It was one of their highest priorities. Now, do the lending agencies realize that state governments have discrepancies between the administrative branch and the legislative branch? Absolutely. That's not a big red flag for them. This happens quite often all across America. And that's not a biggest issue as them as getting them control of this. And we'll solve this problem. We'll get it under control here. But I believe that's what we heard, and we're going to hear some more from Ledge Finance. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something very quickly. So the power cost equalization has almost $1 billion in it. That would not stop people from being helped with their electric bills. That's still, from my understanding, a statute, a law, $44 million that would have been paid out of that fund that went there. So just because there's that much in there doesn't mean it can't be talked about whether or not we leave that. That would not stop us from funding those who need that help. I just want to make sure that's on the record. The other part that we keep talking about, too, Mr. Chair, is that we have more than just employees and funds come. We have a lot of programs, a lot of formula programs that have absolutely nothing to do with employees that go out that could be looked at to be adjusted. So we're not talking about that. A lot of grants for different things. So the budget's about more than just personnel, and it kind of makes it sound like it's all about just personnel, but there's a lot more parts to it. But just one question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. So I heard you say, I believe Representative Sadler, about talking about doing other things. I'm assuming that means restricting travel, perhaps, making so where vacancies might have to come through the governor's office. Are there any of those kind of restrictions currently going on since the governor has been in office, knowing that our deficit has increased every day? Has any of those types of programs been put in place? Because we also heard from some others that past governors have done like a 10% cut in wages when things were, you know, going down until the spike went back up. So in the current budget, has there been anything put in place so that maybe the bleeding is not going so much down the line?
Through Chair, Representative Wilson, each commissioner was asked to, based on the operations of their agencies, to look at ways to conserve as much as possible. Every commissioner understands
the budget reductions that they're going to face. So every savings that they can put in place in this year's budget will allow them to take full advantage of it in next year's budget. Different commissioners have different vacancy holds and different travel holds depending on the activity of the agency. For instance, it would be very difficult to have a travel hold on prisoner transport, but a travel hold on particular Department of Commerce items, those could happen. So it's been program specific and taking advantage as much as possible of the vacancies to have those vacancies help us make up the nearly $389 million reduction between last conference or last year's management plan and this year's conference committee budget that has to be taken out. That's over $1 million a day less spending from this fiscal year to next fiscal year.
And Mr. Chair, for you, if we could get a copy of some of those so we could better understand where the savings are now, so that we have, because sometimes when you come back with a lower budget next year, it's because these were put in place and maybe things changed, but we had a better understanding of who's in place on the travel, what kind of vacancies from the department. That would be very helpful for me. Thank you.
Pat, you got that?
Okay. Not in my pocket.
Well, I'm sure you've got staff here that's recording the questions, and as the questions come back from Ms. Pitney, and we'll get them back to the members to make sure they're the same process we always use. It's been a pretty good process how that works, to make sure all members are informed. Okay. Let's get back into the bill here then, and I just wanted to allow people to get a little bit of these questions off the top, and I think that's been a good conversation for all of us to get started on this. On the Department of Education and Early Development, specifically what was in there was about $599.7 million for the Alaska Learning Network. And for those who aren't familiar with what that is, it's a partnership with the University of Alaska Southeast that allows high school students to take university classes remotely. Program cost in FY15 was $850,000. The legislature covered it as a one-time request and asked the department to prepare a plan for sustainability of AKLN, or ACLN as it's referred to. The governor requested $600 million for the program in 16, submitted a plan on February 23rd when we received the budget in 15. This legislature decided that we were not going to fund it in the conference committee budget. And that's where we're at right now. So, again, the $250,000 reduction of FY15 reflects the increased course fees that were there and reduced expenditures and expanded partnerships with private groups. Pat, do you want to cover that one and why the administration feels that that program is so absolutely important? And one thing that I will mention is this committee, many of us felt that it was good to try and protect the core within the departments, the core missions within the departments, whether it's education. That was my direction to the subcommittee chairs, to look within the cores and identify the core missions of that in programs that were outside the core mission they should be looking at. Someday when we get an economy back, if we hadn't protected the core, we wouldn't be able to bring those departments back as easily. So protect the core. Protect the core was our mission. Things outside the core were looked at, and these were one of those programs that were looked at. And as we go through this bill, again, a question that I had by Ms. Pitney earlier was, how do we want to present this? And I said, it's just like any other piece of legislation. This is a piece of legislation that's introduced by the governor. She brings it in front of the committee. The committee asks questions, and we do our due diligence. That's the discovery process. It is the legislature. It's the process that we're going to follow on this piece of legislation. So, Pat, let's just start at the top, and we'll just work our way through each one of these individual programs. We'll start with education, work our way through those programs. So, again, Alaska Learning Network and our partnership, why is it ultimately extremely important to the state, in the administration's opinion?
So this particular program provides distance education for the core high school requirements to be eligible for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. And in many of our rural high schools. These are not available. Students from 47 different districts have taken these courses to help them qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Having access to higher education provides access to future jobs, provides an educated citizenry for businesses in our state. So it is a program that's been used and valuable. We feel like it has an opportunity to provide access to education to our rural citizens.
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Bitney, I'm not sure if you might have been reading from something on this, and I know that you're new to the administration, but, I mean, that in its overview, I think, was what ACLIN, or Alaska Learning, certainly started out to be, and that was its, I'll say a grand theme. I have always felt that technology is how we're going to do things different and more creative, especially in education, but this program has been around long enough, has taken, and I'll admit that I had the subcommittee. It's taken a lot of money over the last couple of years. It's transferred from what its original idea was over to the university and kind of floundered there. And quite frankly, adopted the APEX program with the MATSU does greatly. I mean, I'm not here to brag about the MATSU, but when I can, I do. They've done a great job. The MATSU has certainly acknowledged that they have the APEX program. They can provide that same program for a lot less money. And we brought that forward before. So why would we have a dual program that costs us more money when somebody else is willing in doing it and cutting out the middleman? So that's where my bigger thing. It's not about the MATSU, but that we're trying to tell school districts to work across school district lines, to share information with one another, and so adding this back in, essentially adding APEX back in, why do we have a middleman? We don't need it. So I guess that would be my question.
Ms. Pidney.
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I hear your statement. Thank you.
Well, I have a few questions, and again, last year, the FY15, the legislature converted it to a one-time and requested the department prepare a plan for the sustainability of the Alaska Learning Network. I don't believe we received a plan on that. So the Department of Education had notification on this earlier that we were looking at this. This is not something that hit them out of the blue, that this has had a red flag out of last year. Do you know why there was never a plan prepared and presented to the legislature while we were doing the budget on this plan?
Representative Newman, I'm not aware that there wasn't a plan. I don't know that that there's a plan in place that wasn't presented, or if there's not a plan that wasn't presented. I'm not aware.
And I understand with changes in administration, those kinds of things can happen. And I've got a couple other questions, if I can. Then we have Representative Wilson and Gere. And as we ask these questions, maybe there'll be some of the questions that are answered here. Are these questions available statewide?
Representative Newman, yes, they are. And students from 47 districts have taken them, are taking them.
So how much do students pay per class?
Representative Newman, this is a school district agreement. And so in addition to this funding, then the school districts pay $150 for the student to take the course, which counts as a half a credit, is a semester-long, you know, algebra course or pre-calculus course or whatever the course happens to be. It's but it's an agreement between the program and the school district to allow students access to this. It's not a student-paid access. It's to replace the lack of APS qualifying courses in their current school district.
Okay, so if we've got, because we've got rural attendance areas and we've got organized areas within the state and the differences in the school districts, so if the school districts are paying that in the REAs, how are they coming out for the funding on that since they're basically state-funded programs?
Representative Newman, it's the school districts pay some portion of it, and then there's a base, the $599 would act as the base for the program. The additional money to offer the full program is made up with the amount of money that the school districts are paying.
Okay. And so what we'll do, I think what's going to work today is because of the questions that we're having today, if we can, and then Ms. Crittenden, if you got your staff and people, you know, recording these questions, tomorrow we'll come back and get some of the questions or answers that you don't have the specific answers for, so we'll review this back again tomorrow. It's the questions on the funding and prepared plans. Are the fees based on the need? Is there a needs-based fee, or how is the fee structure done?
Representative Newman, no. It's based on a school district agreement.
And then does the governor support using the higher education fund as a funding source for this?
The governor would be amenable to either funding source.
Either funding source? Good. And then, again, if you can bring us back a structure of how the funding mechanisms work between the little attendance areas and organized areas of the boroughs and where that money comes from to the school district so that the community can better understand the mechanism that the funding comes through. Representative Wilson and Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had the subcommittee for education when this project was born. And we talked every year about making it self-sustainable. We always promised every year. What we're basically doing is we're paying twice for a high school student to take a course because they're taking the course online where they're paying $150, where the state then is paying a different amount for that child to be in the schools. So one of the ideas that we had gone to the department with is, why would you not give the same amount of whatever it is for that child to be in that place and make it self-sustainable? And they just said that was too much. But now we have more options, and I guess that's what my question is. Not just paying twice, but now with other programs we just okayed last year in finance, back to crossing school lines and being able to do that, there are programs out there they could directly go and get these types of programs because they're doing programs that have nothing to do with the scholarship program at all. In fact, their number one program at least a year ago was Education 101, and they got a free iPad. So the question I had with them was it because they got the free iPad that they signed up, or was it because we were offering Education 101, which I guess looked into whether they wanted to be a teacher? So first of all, how is this not duplicating? We're paying for the high school student to be in that seat one amount, and now we're paying out of another pot for them to take a course because it's not offered in the school.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the base money is the funding for creation and building the course, and the funding from the school district is the delivery of the course. So it takes a tremendous amount to make these courses available, and it's having the structure and the system to have those courses available to the rural places. To the degree that it's the choice of this body to use APEX instead of ACRM, it's fine. We believe in this administration.
The acronyms on them, so the public understands.
Yeah. The last learning network, and excuse me, I'm not familiar with APEX, but I will get familiar with APEX. But it is this group's, again, the document that is provided provides a restatement of the governor's priorities and a starting point for a discussion to get to a fully funded budget. And
okay.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
I just want to make sure that when we're putting programs out here, we're really talking about what the program is. Because the Ketchikan School District already has these courses much cheaper that are on that level. MAPSU has these programs. Fairbanks started ones where they were sharing between their high schools. So they exist. And that's not even talking about the university who has online courses that you could take some of these courses with. So this isn't about a conversation starter, Ms. Pitney, because I want to make sure people understand what this program is. I think when it started back in Chatham when they initially got the grant, I believe it probably was one of the only things that existed. But as it's kind of floundered from there to Wrangell to, I think it was in Juneau for a while, I mean, it just could never find a home. Finally, we thought we found a home in Ketchikan because they actually have tons of programs. Kenai is one of the number one places in the state that already have these programs already made, all ready to go. So I don't understand your point where you're saying that they're having to develop these courses. These courses are already developed. Do you understand that these are already developed and being utilized online in other school districts willing to share?
Through Chair Representative Wilson, we can get an expert on the Alaska Learning Network in here to go through those. I'm responding to this is a priority of the administration, and this is one of several priorities that we've put out for consideration while you're considering how to get to a FY16 fully funded budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be a conversation starter if we didn't already have it existing. And I guess that's just what my point is that we have those in the state. We should really be encouraging others to share versus trying to start something new. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And we'll, I think Pat's trying to do her best as the Director of Office Management and Budget to try and cover some of this stuff. And for people who have been kind of scattered too, so we've put in requests if you try and have the people here that you can. So if you can't, maybe tomorrow, questions that we have unanswered, we'll try and make sure we've got them people available. President Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, let me have you refresh us on the numbers. Last year, the Alaska Learning Network was funded at, what, $850,000? And the governor funded it at $600,000, and then the House cut it down to zero, and then in conference it was moved back to $600,000. Is that accurate? Or tell me what is accurate.
Through the Chair, Representative Gara, last year was $850,000, this current year that we're standing in, $850,000. In our FY16 proposal, we dropped it to $599.7 million. Understanding that we could expect more revenue from the users. Then it was dropped to zero through the legislative process. So at this point, it will be cut completely. This is reconsideration to allow for additional figuring out how to have the program get additional revenue to sustain it.
Thank you. Okay, the Chair.
That was not funded through the conference today.
Sure, thank you. Thank you, through the Chair. And Pat, just I guess maybe you can help me understand the comments that there are parts of this program that are duplicative. My understanding of background is this. The Governor Parnell passed a merit scholarship and a needs-based scholarship a few years ago. To qualify for the merit scholarship, you have to take certain higher-level courses that are not available in many school districts. To have a scholarship that's available only to some students and not to students who happen to live in those districts where those courses aren't available would be unfair. So ACLIN was extended to those communities where those courses weren't available. Is there any duplication that you know of that I'm missing? I suppose if there is, we can work on it. But we're just extending these courses to smaller communities that don't have them available so their students can qualify for the same scholarships as people in Anchorage. Is that not correct?
To Chair Representative Gara, that is the understanding, and that is why this administration has it prioritized.
Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize Ms. Pitney may not have the letter that the Matson School District sent to all the other superintendents, and I'll make sure you get a copy of it as we go on. But those opportunities are available for other school districts. So this isn't the only place. The unfortunate part is the state's been spending money, and I think in the initial, and I wasn't sure, in the initial invention of it, if you will, that they thought that we as Alaskan teachers would all come together and put something together very Alaskan. Unfortunately, that has not worked. What they're doing right now is they're utilizing an outside program called APEX, A-P-E-X. And it doesn't stand for anything but APEX, just to make that real clear. Okay. And certainly the MATSU has used it as their some online courses, some recovery courses, and so on and so forth. It's worked really well, and the MATSU has extended it to the other 53 school districts. So that opportunity is out there for the and far less than $150 per class. And it's the same program that Akron has finally chosen to use. So we're talking apples and apples. Really what we're talking about is the cost. In my opinion, what we want to do, as we have less and less money in our budgets, we want school districts to share. Quite frankly, we don't want the government to get involved and say, don't share, let us pay for it, in a government that doesn't have the money to do that. So it's simply not a cross-party lines. It's about it's utilizing our money to the best that we can and saving what we have left over for other areas. And I would think, and I'll make sure that I share this with my other committee members, so that we can all be on the same page in regards to Akron, because I really think that this is a non-starter. I think when you know more about it, I think we'll all come together on that. So, back with your conversation starter, I do believe that we've hit the first one here, and I think that we've got something here. So I will share that information and make sure that that you're on board with the same information.
All right. Thank you, Representative Gass. That's some good information for us. Kathy, any comments on that?
Yep. All right.
Akron. One down. $600,000. Next we have, just going down through the list here, with the education type programs, there was a $2 million request to restore $2 million in UGF for pre-K grants. Pre-K grants were funded at $2 million in FY15. The governor proposed reducing that amount by $100,000. The legislature zeroed out funding for the program. The governor's special session budget requests the full $2 million that was distributed in FY15. In FY15, the grants went to six school districts to serve a total of 308 students. The grants are awarded competitively to school districts to allow students from families at or below poverty line to attend pre-K programs. The program began as a pilot in 2009, but was not expanded after the initial pilot period. Little background information on it. So, Ms. Pitney, why do we feel that this is something that's definitely imminent within the governor's proposed budget?
The students served are the most at-risk students, and the results from the grants have demonstrated that.
What is an at-risk student?
The low-income students in need, and the programs that have demonstrated that their grade average comes up, and that gives them a much better start in schools. And so the results that they've found have been good. Yes, it serves a small number of students, but giving that small number of students a great start is an important approach, and it's what those school districts can learn from the programs put in place and then carry those on. So
I just want to clarify then, it's $2 million for 308 students that are all pre-K. So my first question that comes to mind is, do parents apply for these grants? How are they judged? How are they evaluated? How does this program work? I mean, we've got a lot of pre-K kids out there, and probably a lot of parents who don't know about this program, or maybe do know about this program, I'm not quite so sure that there's, you know, every parent knows about the opportunities that are involved here, but that's a lot of money right now in this budget with $2 million for 308 kids. So So if we can get some information on how this program is evaluated, the type of evaluations that you are going to say at risk, and some results. This has been around since 2009. We should have some results right now that you should be able to show us that, say, by investing that much per student, that by the time they're in, what, fifth grade by now, they should, you know, they're A students or B students or wherever they're at in their life. So if we can get those results as to why this business, the value of $2 million in a budget with, we have a tremendous amount of budget restraints, if we can get that, just to level Representative Wilson, do you have a question?
Sure, why not? So these are extended Head Start programs is what they are. They're not new pre-K programs. They're extended programs. And so those, again, this is what I had for 4 years, and there is data showing that at the beginning most of these children do better, but by the third grade, most of these programs have shown that everybody else has caught up. There has not been increase, at least on this program, but again, these are kids who are just getting, children who are getting to that point, but as we, but those programs haven't stayed in the same school since 2009. They've gone out every 2 years to be traded out there. My bigger question is that once someone gets this grant, who makes sure that they can then self-sustain it after that point? Because that's what I've heard more than anything is, if I receive the grant, no one asks then, after my grant's over in 2 years, how am I going to continue that grant, or does it just move on to someone else? And although this shows it being about $6,500 per student, that's in addition to the Head Start monies that are already given for that student, which can range up to about $16,000 per child is what we had figured out at what point. But my question is on this particular program, what has been done to make sure that they would be able to sustain the program? Because, again, it's only for every 2 years and it moves on and becomes competitive again.
I'll follow up on that.
Okay, so we'll try and get the information for you. Thank you. Do you have any further questions? President Vera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bibney, I guess I, for one, am glad that you put the pre-K grants back in. The studies show that low-income children who go through pre-K earn more money, end up in the job market in bigger numbers, end up in jail in smaller numbers. It's evidence-based. And I'm not sure if you're familiar, but maybe you are. When Governor Palin started this, at the urging of a lot of people in 2008, the statement was by the commissioner, if you prove it works, we'll start expanding it statewide. 40 other states have statewide pre-K. We don't. And it was proven successful. Studies came out. Academic achievement and intellectual acuity went up. And with that promise, the goal was to start making this available to more children, but we're still at the same spot as we were in 2008 or 2009. Do you think it'll be a smart move to go backwards and just eliminate this program? Because we've already eliminated other parts of pre-K, parents as teachers, which is a very important pre-K program, and I think that should be restored. Where are we going if we eliminate pre-K and we eliminate parents as teachers in this state?
Through the chair, Representative Gara.
That's somewhat philosophical. I believe you don't have a lot of those answers in front of you. So
I did want to note that there were in the range of about $7 million in pre-K type programs, inclusive of this, well, it was 1.9, were reduced as part of the education budget this year. So the education non-formula budget was reduced by, 30% in a conference committee budget. With these restores, it reduces the education non-formula budget by 26%. It's maintaining a small piece. They are we recognize we're in a tough time, and we accepted many of the reductions that came through the conference committee, but wanted to restore some pre-K options. So whether it's this particular program or other pre-K options, it does make a difference to the citizens. It does make a difference in our schools, makes a difference in our job market, and it's a smart investment.
And then, you know, obviously for the people sitting on this side of the desk, when you're having to pull, you know, $3+ billion out of savings, and we know that the price of oil isn't going to be going up probably very fast, and we'll continue to have to draw upon our savings, every $2 million counts. They start to add up. And the guy who had to have all this spit out in front of him and try and find out $100,000 here and $100,000 there, $2 million is a lot of money. You know, does it come out of Alaska State Troopers, emergency services, health and social services? There's only just so much money to go around. And then a lot of hard decisions were had to made by this legislature. And where some of them are good for Olympics, how do you prioritize them? That's the discussion that we're having right now. Representative Salen.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Ms. Pittman, you said that pre-K is important for schools, for families, and for the workforce. If you do have evidence that shows the effects of pre-kindergarten are felt in the job market, where the students in question have some advantage of, in the job market, I'd sure appreciate seeing that. And again, the question I'd ask, I guess it's the same kind of question the Chair has just asked. If pre-K is important, and these are the governor's priorities, is pre-kindergarten program more important than post-kindergarten program? In other words, if there is the financial constraints we do face, and pre-K is important enough to make it a priority, where else in the administration's view of education costs could be reduced to accommodate that $2 million?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, you know, there was in the range of, like I said, $7
million. Wow.
Echo. In the range of $7 million on pre-K, there's $15 million reduced in education overall. And this is in the non-formula components of education, grant programs, other programs. So it's not that there's not room for reduction. We've accepted much of the reductions. It's just how much. Is it everything? Is it every program that we have in the pre-K? Or is it just many of the programs that we've accepted as reductions by this body?
I'm not quite sure what you just said. Again, my question was, if this is a priority and pre-K, therefore, it might be more important than other programs, what other programs is pre-K more important than that could maybe accommodate to reduce those programs to accommodate this? We're talking like from here on, not what's happened in the past. Yes, they're having reductions, but your budget document is proposing to increase. So help me understand what we could reduce elsewhere to accommodate that $2 million.
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, there were, again, over $380 million of reductions. It's the speed of the reductions. Do you want to pit this program against, you know, legislative desks? Do you want to pit this program against legislative staff? Do you want to pit this program against governor staff? It's a balance. And I think to say what is this more important than this or that? This is a pre-K issues in our state are important. And this is a commitment to the priorities that the governor set, but also accepts that there's tremendous reductions already placed in this budget, over $15 million.
Chair Newman?
Yeah,
this is Rep Thompson. I'm down in Juneau. I had a question on that pre-K. From what I've been able to research and read, in FY15, there were only six school districts that received parts of this money for pre-K, and of that, there were only 308 students in pre-K from these grants. Is that correct? Ms. Pitney?
Through the Chair, Representative Thomas. Thompson, that's my, that is my understanding as well.
A follow-up, Rep. Newman.
Representative Thompson.
So if the governor was asked to cut this in half, would he still want to keep this program? And it's only served 308 students with that amount in FY15. I'm a little confused as to why. What does he want to do with this program if he just wants to do 300 students? Is that still what he has as a priority?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, if it were the advice we've gotten from the Commissioner of Education is if it's reduced to $1 million, it's really not going to be very efficient to continue it. The plan when it was started was to move it to a broader statewide audience versus just the six areas. So the advice we have is if it's going to be cut in half, it might as well be just reduced completely. It's not the size enough to be as effective as if the plan was followed to expand the program more statewide.
Final statement, Chair Newman.
Representative Thompson.
Yeah, you know, it's probably a very good program, but I think when it was put into place, we weren't expecting oil to drop down to 60% reduction in our budget. And I can't justify a pilot program that still hasn't been proved and does not have any way of reaching more students than with this amount of money, the additional 308 students next year. That's not very many students and not very efficient, so I can't justify this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Mr. Chair, just briefly. Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I keep hearing this still hasn't been proved, and I guess people haven't seen the report or it's been proved. Can we have Commissioner Hanley talk about the proof that this program is working, and then
I think we asked Pat to bring back some information.
Or Pat could bring that back, too. I don't care who does, but it's been proved. And then the statement that it's only serving 308 students, it was supposed to be expanded once it was proven to work, and it never was. So, we've been asked to stop funding things that don't work and to start funding things that are evidence-based and do work. This is evidence-based and does work if we want to create opportunity in the state.
I guess that's a statement.
I'm not going to find a question mark at the end.
Just limited funds. Representative Wilson.
I just wanted to verify something, Mr. Chair. So, as we're talking about other pre-K programs, I just don't know the answer to this. So for Head Start, which we have a state portion of that, was any of that reduced? I'm pretty sure it wasn't, so I just want to make sure that it's on record that some of the other grants you're talking is Parents with Teachers Best Beginnings, but Head Start's in a whole different portion of the budget. So this affects maybe some Head Start students, but I don't think in the budget that Head Start itself saw any less state funding. So I'd just like to make sure that that's correct.
Is there other pre-K programs that are being funded currently?
Head Start, just so you know, Head Start is, a lot of it's federal money, but we also match some of that with state funding. And then what the pre-K pilot program was kind of like a more specific way to stack on top of that into those programs. What's made it very hard to prove whether or not this program is or isn't working is that the beginning years, they weren't testing all the children. So it was hard to be able to figure out what was going on with it. And children come in and out, and it's just been growing. But I just want to make sure today, as we're talking about, I don't know what you're talking about on the outside education funding, when we're talking about pre-K here, outside, because these are all outside of the school districts. None of the Head Starts are part of the K-12 or even the preschool programs within the school. So I just want to make sure it's on record that whether or not we decreased Head Start funding, because I'm 95% sure we did not. And maybe the one on the end can tell us because she had that budget.
Yeah. I will follow up on the exact status of the Head Start funding. Almost all other pre-K options were eliminated completely. So just the reduction for education, the non-formula components of education, it was $57 million and education programs last year. The conference committee has it has now $39 million, so an $18 million reduction in education grants. That's pre-K and other programs. And then this is these two programs request $2.6 million back. So.
It's just a number, Mr. Chair.
President Kerr.
Thank you. Pat, if you could just at the next meeting bring us a number. We know there wasn't $18 million in pre-K, so $18 million has been cut from non-formula education programs. Could you just give us a detail of what that $18 million was? Just for folks who care, but the Head Start state contribution has only gone up twice in the last 15 years, so it's otherwise been flat.
Okay. President Gaddis is our Budget Finance Subcommittee Chair for Education. He's very familiar with these programs also. Used to be on the Manchester Borough School District School Board. So she's very familiar with these issues. So I wanted to send her a note there to follow up last on this if she can give us her opinion on some of the questions and we talked to. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that setup. Certainly we've, thank you, Ms. Pitney, through the chair. I've heard some of the questions and some of the other statements, and I've seen you taking notes, so I won't address those. I will address how I approached it when I looked at the budget, and I looked at unsustainable programs. I looked at pilot programs that we couldn't afford, and that they were not being sucked up, if you will, by the local communities. Some of the conversation that we've heard here, especially from my colleague with the same initials down at the end, where he talked about pre-K, we have no pre-K. Sure we do. We have pre-K in a lot of our communities. They're private pre-Ks. We do have parents as teachers. Not the actual program, but let's not forget, for all the parents sitting in the room, they have been parents as teachers. They're allowed to be parents as teachers. The government is not going to take away that opportunity to enrich your preschoolers. And so that is also a program, but it also, as we talk about it here, we say we're taking away parents as teachers. No, we're not. Parents can still be teachers to their kids. They can still make the determination how to enrich those people's lives, and we should never, as the government, take away that opportunity. And I think that that's one of the things that I looked at when I looked at this particular budget, and I thought, how much is the government literally taking away so we're no longer doing what we used to do? And I didn't go to pre-K, and I didn't go to kindergarten here in Alaska, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan living in the bush area, and I had great teachers without pre-K and without kindergarten. Now, I know that we have kindergarten now, too, but what are the things that we can afford to do? And certainly, this was over 40 years ago, but that's what I looked at, the constitutional mandates that we have to do and that we should do for education. So when I looked at some of these things that I took up, that's what, and quite frankly, these pre-K programs serve very few kids, in particular for all the rest of the state. There are other programs I'd like to see, and I have made this discussion in visiting communities. I would like to see in the villages, I'd like to see the tribal organizations participate and step up further. They're their kids. So that's why we made the cut, and we felt it was time for others to pitch in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. And certainly Representative Wilson, we've had this budget before, and then Representative Wilson and Gaddis went statewide with discussions in school districts and talking to parents among this program and many programs within the Department of Education. So their expertise in this area is well-grounded within this committee, and certainly thank them for their information and the amount of effort and time that they both spent on education. I know that I, at one time, chaired the Education Committee a few years back, and there's a lot to education in Alaska, a lot of different components to that. Any further discussion on the pre-K $2 million program? Representative Gaddis.
And Mr. Chair, just one final thought as we leave, potentially leave, Dean. remembering that ACLIN was started with our funds back in the day. And so if we don't have those funds anymore, We're doing things, we're going to do things different if the federal government isn't paying. So just a reminder in our heads as we go through this. Thank you.
Okay. Now it's public education.
So Commissioner Lucan has graciously joined us today, and he has an all-day meeting tomorrow. So rather than take these in order, if we could take transportation up and invite Commissioner Lucan, then we get that one out of the way today so he doesn't have to use this tomorrow.
Commissioner Lucan, come on forward. From the Alaska Department of Transportation Public Facilities, the Alaska Marine Highway System. We had a request in Hospital 1001 for some background on it. So the UGF Conference Committee budget for the Alaska Marine Highway System is $12.5 million below the FY15. However, the increase of $2.6 million appropriated from Alaska Marine Highway System Fund Capitalization Account brings the net reduction to $9.9 million. In addition, an argument could be made that Alaska Marine Highway System is further reduced by a portion of the fuel trigger appropriation that they received in the FY15, which was $4.8 million, that is not likely to be received in the FY16. Because of the $70 barrel and the way the fuel trigger works, based on the per barrel cost on them. For those of us who work with the fuel trigger, it was a mechanism to try and account for the high cost of oil and the high cost of fuel within the program statewide, for the departments that had to buy fuel. So there was a formula that was divided out for an oil that was higher than that. So the exact impact is unknown, but we can assume that with the lower fuel prices as a result of lower oil prices, will alleviate some of the loss of the $4.8 million. Further, there is approximately $5.5 million of the fuel trigger appropriation that has not yet been distributed to agencies. That money can be distributed to the Alaska Marine Highway System and carried forward into FY16. That is a request that the Finance Committee would make, working with Ms. Pitney on that one to do that. That action appears to be integral to the $7 million request from the governor. The two accounts combined would provide an additional $12.5 million for the system in FY16. According to DOTPF, full summer service is currently scheduled and could be provided if the $12.5 million is available. Winter service from October 2015 to June 2016 would be reduced, impacting the Malaspina's Bellingham to Southeast Alaska run. Without the $7 million addition, the October to June will be more significantly impacted. Commissioner, let's just take it from there in the fuel trigger, the accounting, the funding, and let's first start off with, I believe, and I'm going back in memory here, I don't have it in front of me, the appropriation to the Alaska Marine Highway System was about $140 million total, offense.
Well, what I have, first of all, Mark Lucan, the Department of Transportation Public Facilities.
Thank you, Commissioner.
What I have in front of me, I think, is the fact that I believe the appropriation...
Why don't you let me take
you
the budget? I'll
that.
Do the budget ones. He can do the run ones.
Ms. Pitney.
So the conference committee has passed as $153.9 million
for the Marine Highway System.
For the Marine Highway System, all funds.
All funds.
The governor's request was $167.4 million. The analysis that you just provided was accurate, and with the exception that there's permission. There is an assumed fair increase that will not generate the funds that were given receipt authority for. So there was a $1.8 million receipt availability that if you put the fare in January when it was suggested by the legislature to put it in, would not return $1.8 million, especially on the scheduled runs. So, but all other, your analysis on the budget is correct. So going back to your specific question, currently passed at the conference committee is $153.9 million. That does not count the fuel trigger mechanism that you discussed, nor does it count the $7 million request that is part of this additive budget. So with that, you can talk about the operations of it.
Okay, so what I was trying to get to is a $7 million reduction out of $150 to $60 million appropriation of the Marine Highway System, less than 0.5%. When we looked at some of the reductions that we have to do, I don't feel that that's a significant impact. So the commissioner is here to tell us why that is a significant impact.
So, Representative Newman, I believe the math is 4.5%, not 0.5%. But,
just doing
I don't do math in public very well either. So, but what I'd like to really spend time on is talk about why we have the budget we have, and the budget request we have was based on what we assumed in July of last year was going to be the funding available, and therefore why we published the schedule we published in October of last year. And that is our typical process, is to publish a schedule that will be in effect through the summer. And as a result, with the current conference committee passed funding, that will significantly impact the schedule that was published. Currently, we have roughly, and we haven't canceled any reservations at this point. I think that's another important point to make, is that we are continuing to wait until we know what our budget will be. But at some point, we are going to have to start making phone calls. With the current funding that was passed out of the conference committee, there's roughly 2,900 reservations at risk because of the impact to the summer schedule. That equates to about 10,000 people. So that's why we have come back and asked for the budget that we've asked for, so that we can honor the commitments that we've made through the schedule to run the sailing per the schedule this summer.
So, Commissioner, I personally have a little bit of trouble with this. We did meet with the Marine Highway Systems Director, Captain Chaben, amongst some of the other people in control in the Marine Highway System, Representative Stutes and Senator Gary Stevens and I, and had a discussion with them. And what we talked about was exactly what you're trying to talk about, is this ferry impact and why the state of Alaska has to have more money to put into there. One of the suggestions that we put forward was that the Marine Highway System look at impacts on the ferry ports that are on the road system, and the realignment of the ferry system to try and realize some additional savings that way. So if we've got people in Whittier, Seward, Homer, that are, you know, even Valdez, that are on the road system, you know, those people may have to drive a little bit longer. And we thought that it would be more reasonable than ports where there is no road system, Cordova, Haines. You know, I guess Haines is a little bit on the road system, but areas, Kodiak. We never really got an accurate response back as to why or how that would be impacted. Just in a suggestion by some of our legislators, both from the Senate and the House representatives, on suggestions who are used that ferry system for many years of their life. You know, why didn't we look at other things like that instead of just, you got to give us more money to put more programs in here because we made these commitments?
And yes, it is 5% or so, somewhere around there, 149. For those, do the math there. But that's the, I think, a very reasonable reduction in the budget, particularly with the price of fuel going down. Talk to me about why we didn't come back with a compromise on some of those ports that are on the road system.
Well, you know, as I said in testimony last week, we'd be, you know, we could do that. We certainly could do that. And we could cancel the run to Skagway and just run to Haines and ask those people who go to Skagway to drive 352 miles from Haines to make it to their home. That's certainly an option. And we could explore that. The point is that if you know, the kind of cancellations we're going to have to make are cancellations that are again based on the schedule we have already printed. And I can guarantee you that when we come to you next year, well, actually, when we publish a schedule next year, it's going to be considerably more conservative than the schedule we have for this year.
Could you talk a little closer to the mic, please?
Certainly.
I want to make sure people in the back can hear.
Right. Well, it just went down. Okay.
Chair Newman?
No.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
Yes, Commissioner Lucan, I just have a couple of questions that I'd like to have some answers put together on because I'm not sure on my numbers. But looking back about 1988, I think we have two more ships today than we did back then. I think we've added maybe two to three ports of call since 1988. But in 1988, we were bringing in well over 60% of the revenue to fund the operation. Today, we're around 30% is all we're bringing in against the expense. So I'd like to know what those cost drivers are and a few answers like that. If you could get those for us, I'd appreciate that because it seems like we've really went backwards. I'm sure that we have a lot more people riding today than we did back in 1988, but yet we're going backwards as far as covering our costs. So if you could get some of those numbers for us, I'd sure appreciate it.
Good day, Chair. Representative Thompson, and we'd be glad to do that. And I can tell you again, as I mentioned before, that the schedule that we will publish for FY17 will be radically different than the schedule we published for FY16, primarily because we don't want to go through this drill again.
If you could even tell us how that new schedule compares to the ones back in the late 80s, possibly. I mean, see what kind of a comparison we have there. Thank you.
Thank you. And then, Commissioner, again, with the $5.5 million that will be going back to the department in money from the fuel trigger, that's additional $5.5 million that you didn't have to come up with from the start. I mean, how does that fit into your budget then? Along with the lower fuel prices through the rest of the year, which I would imagine be considerable amount of savings.
Representative Newman, the budget was based on having the fuel trigger, or the schedule was based on having the fuel trigger. So that immediately, you know, without a fuel trigger, that immediately impacts the schedule and the impact to that schedule. On top of that, the fuel trigger is based on $2.65 per gallon for diesel, and I don't believe we've reached, or our fuel costs are based on, $2.65 for fuel. And I don't believe we've reached that point yet in the cost of fuel.
These were, if I remember correctly, Pat, unused funds from last year's fuel trigger that we asked the administration to Ms. Pitney to direct reback to put additional money into the ferry system. Did we do that, Pat?
Representative Newman, this essentially replaces next year's fuel trigger amount because this year they're using in the order of $9 million in fuel trigger funding. The additional 5.5, that $9 million in fuel trigger money is zero next year. So that zero does not show in the 153 million. that is not accounted for because the fuel trigger mechanism now is zero in FY16. So that 5.5 bridges the elimination of the fuel trigger mechanism.
Okay. So we have an order. I'll let some of the other members ask some questions here. We've got to expand this a little bit. We have Representative Gaddis, Wilson, Sadler, and Pruitt. Representative Gaddis.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. So the 7 million puts what routes back into service?
The 7 million, I believe, will cover the Lynn Canal run for the summer.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, without the 7 million, through the chair, I apologize, you're saying the Lynn Canal will not be serviced without the 7 million.
It won't be serviced by the Malaspina, which covers most of the traffic in the summer.
And to the chair, so what I'm hearing you say is that they will not have service unless it's by the Malaspina. So what I'm really trying to figure out is there other service that they'll have, but the Malaspina will not be there?
That's correct. Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, there will be some service in the Lynn Canal. But not the bulk of the service will not be covered by the Malaspina.
So through the chair, I'm going to say it a different way. There's service, but there'll be more service if we give you 7 million.
There will be service through the chair, Representative Gaddis. There will be service to cover the schedule that was already printed.
I understand that, but backing up, there will be service, but giving you 7 million, it will be more service, and more importantly, it'll follow the printed schedule that you already have printed.
Through the chair, that is correct.
So we're not taking away service. We're just adding more to it to allow that schedule, correct? I don't mean to be that confusing. I guess my second question is this new answer to the first one, and that is that they'll still have service. They just won't have as many stops, and the Malaspina won't be running. I get that. But my previous career was working for the airlines, and it's not uncommon that we change schedules, and we change printed schedules. And sometimes we cancel schedules, and, you know, you might have flown an airplane in on a daily basis. Now you're only flying in once a week or twice a week. That is not super uncommon, and I certainly think that it's an opportunity to contact folks, and today with email and such, to say, here are your other options. But unfortunately, you don't get the service that we might have had because we've changed your schedule. Anyway, I certainly still think that is an option. I don't know, are there other places, and I did cut you off, that will not have service if we don't fund the $7 million?
So through the chair, Representative Gaddis, you are exactly correct in what you just got through saying, and that is exactly what we plan to do if the funding doesn't come back. If we don't receive the funding necessary to run the schedule. So we will certainly try to rebook as many people as we can. But there will be people who we call and say, your trip is canceled. Where the holes are, if you will, in the schedule, there will be no service in Prince William Sound from the middle of September to the middle of October, if the funding doesn't come back. There are no boats available and nor funding available to run service in Prince William Sound for that month. Representative Gaddis.
Through the chair, where in Prince William Sound?
Between Cordova, Valdez, and Whittier.
Okay. I went to high school in Cordova, so the Tustamina a lot. But the 7 million is not just for that service. It includes that service, correct?
To the chair, that is correct.
Okay, and I guess I would like to see, certainly there's no road to Cordova, so the only way that they have that service is by air or by ferry. So if we only served Cordova, the Prince William Sound in this case, it's not 7 million. I wonder what that cost would be.
Chair, Representative Gaddis, we can certainly get you what that cost would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It would have been nice to have that right now while we're talking about this. So, we have Representative Wilson Sadler for Root and Gear. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, let's get back to the 2,900 at risk, 10,000 people. What does it equate to as money? Because you told us it was 2,900 people who are reserved, which is 10,000 people. At how much do we get when if those are kept?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I'll have to get you that revenue, what the revenue would generate from that.
Okay, follow-up?
Representative Wilson, Senator Olson has been in the audience for quite a while listening to this. Staff Finance member from the Senate, so welcome, Senator Olson. Excuse me, Representative Olson.
No problem, and I do find it interesting that we knew how many reservations, but not how much money. But that's just me. So I don't like the ferry a lot, and it takes me a while to drive if I want to drive from North Pole to Anchorage. Or I can do a plane ride.
People can't hear in the back.
Anyway, on the road system, we still have all the same choices, too, as far as do we drive or do we do a plane. But what I'm hearing here, though, is that the Lynn Canal, whether or not we do that, or Cordova, is a choice that someone has made. You could have just as easily made it between Skagway and Haines, because for people from Skagway to drive over to Haines, it's actually, I think, still shorter than what it takes me to get from North Pole to Anchorage. So I guess I'm trying to figure out what the philosophy was on determining which ones to cut back on. Was there some kind of philosophy on if you pick the ones that had the lowest amount of riders currently on it? How did you decide the Lynn Canal and then the Cordova, Prince William Sound area?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I think a lot of the decisions were based on what ships were available when, because they rotate through, they have layup periods, and also, you know, I'm not an expert on the marine highway system by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, it was based, I believe, on the most, I think the least impact that we could make to the system, the overall summer schedule system, that's probably the best I can answer for you right now.
Okay,
I can get you some details.
Okay, and a follow-up? So on the schedules, do they say anything on them upon availability? Because I know a lot of times when we were out in the bush, the planes were up by availability. Sometimes they came, sometimes not so much. So is there something on the schedule right now that alerts people that this is our best guess at a schedule but may not happen?
The Chair, Representative Wilson, I'd have to look back and see if that's something we print on our schedule.
Okay, and
Representative Gaddis, on that point, I believe.
Yeah, on that point, certainly the tariffs are filed and the schedules are filed, and they have to be filed that way that that if something happens or a boat goes down, that you also. So we've had schedules. I'm trying to think where the ferry, in Old Harbor that we were in, then no longer Testamina was up for work, and the Testamina just didn't go anymore. We didn't say, oh my gosh, we don't have a boat, the schedule, you know, the world's falling apart. We didn't do that. And Old Harbor suffered the consequences. They just didn't have the boat that came in. So, I'm kind of embarrassed as we're kind of beating you up over here about this ferry schedule, but it's truly not that complicated. If we don't have the money, we call these people up and say, I guess you're not coming or you're coming on this other schedule. And we try to schedule whether they're airplanes or they're boats. I realize one's in the air, one's in the water, but they're really not that complicated. Where we save $7 million. And I'm embarrassed to be beating you up, but, you know, I am, because it's really not that complicated.
So through the Chair, Representative Gaddis, we'd be happy to start that today, but we haven't had a schedule, we haven't had a budget yet, and so until we have a budget, we're not going to start making phone calls to let people know whether they're going to be rescheduled or not.
Commissioner, I would suggest you start talking to people about availability. Okay? I mean, this is not a surprise. This is not a surprise, and quite frankly, I'm rather insulted in the fact that that was your response to that. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to understand one more on the fuel trigger. And so the fuel trigger is my, please correct me because I'm still trying to figure this one out, only comes into play if fuel is at a certain price. So as fuel has decreased, I'm imagining you've seen savings on that. Where are the savings that you've received? I'm assuming this last year, as one of the reasons why you have no money is because oil prices have gone down. So have you seen a lot of savings? And am I correct that the fuel trigger only comes into play when fuel is at a certain price?
So, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the reason there was $5.5 million available to provide to the marine highway system is because the need relative to the fuel trigger mechanism was less by 5.5, but they still used $10 million in fuel trigger in the need. In terms of the difference between the cost and their budget for fuel, that's what the fuel trigger is supposed to cover. So it is $5.5 million less than what was available. That $5.5 million is being shifted so they can use it in FY16, where that $8 million that they've used in 15 is gone, and it's replaced with 5.5. They no longer receive that it took $8.8 million to cover their their fuel needs based on the fuel trigger mechanism and their need. And this was Department of Transportation in total.
Just because I'm so confused.
Okay. We're scheduled to adjourn at 3.
But just one quick thing. Maybe you could answer this, Mr. Chair, but does a fuel trigger only, I mean, it's not there all the time. It's only based on higher oil prices so that we're kind of putting more money in knowing it's going to cost more to heat our buildings or is it to run our ferries. I'm just trying to make sure that I'm correct. Okay, thank you. That was much easier. Okay.
So if we can, with that in mind, just I want to make sure we allow the members have already asked to ask a question. If we can just ask maybe one question that's further than Sadler, Fruit, and Gary, and we can walk to adjourn for the day.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason we're having problems with microphones is they're a little bit different to the ones we're used to. They're a lot closer field. So getting close. Fisher, you said that 2,900 reservations were at risk. What do you mean by at risk?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, what I mean by at risk is that at some point we will have a budget. If the budget is currently as depicted out of the conference committee, then that is how many reservations will be impacted one way or the other because of the boats that won't sail, the ships that won't sail. And so as a result of that, we will have to call those 2,900 reservations and let them either try to rebook them or let them know that their reservations canceled.
Okay. So again, through the chair, again, follow up. If HB 72, as passed by the conference committee, goes into effect, they have to contact 2,900 reservations representing about 10,000 people to say that the scheduled sailing is not going to happen exactly, and there are other alternatives, or there are no alternatives. Or actually, there are alternatives. Whether or not they're acceptable to the clients or the customers, it's up to them. Is that correct?
To the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
And are there costs to the individuals to change reservations in that situation?
To the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. Commissioner, so I want to go back to, remind me, when do you set the schedule for the next year? You mentioned that earlier, right?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the schedule is published in October.
Okay. So my question kind of stems from, at that point in time, you don't know what's going to be appropriate for the next year. So how are you able to, how do you set the schedules? My question is we're going through this struggle this year. How do we prevent this from happening next year? Should we be funding the marine highway system basically a year ahead, some sort of an intent that we expect it to be X amount for the next year so we don't encounter this? I mean, any thoughts on trying to prevent this in the future?
Representative Pruitt, I really appreciate that question, and I would tell you that the process has been that we will put together a schedule in roughly July and sit down with the director of the Office of Management and Budget and say, this is what we're proposing. do we believe that we'll have the revenue and the legislature would accept this type of budget, you know, for the marine highway system. So it is somewhat of a guess, but it's a calculated guess based on, you know, what we've experienced in the past. As I've said before, we are going to work with OMB this year to create a schedule that is considerably more conservative, that, you know, does two things. It will, first of all, cut costs by cutting schedule, but we'll also be looking at, you know, how do we generate more revenue? You know, so that, you know, my intent is to bring the, you know, just like Representative Thompson suggested, my intent is to bring our cost recovery rate closer to what it used to be, you know, upwards of 50% if we could. And the only way we're going to do that is in two ways. First, cutting the schedule, you know, reduce the number of sailings, or increasing revenue. One of the, you know, combination of both.
And just quick follow-up on that last
you can
change the fees without legislative approval. Is that correct? Is that under the authority of yourself or your director to do that, or do you need to come to us for that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I believe I have the constitutional right or the regulatory right to change the tariffs.
Okay, thank you.
I think that was a yes.
Yeah.
In the short form. Representative Garrett.
Thanks, Chair. Just a few quick questions. You had considered, somebody asked you to consider an extra 4.5% increase, fare increase, but your analysis was that with the additional fare increase, it wouldn't necessarily raise that much money because less people would ride. Is that recollection correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Garrett, I believe, you know, it's based on the analysis of if we reduce the number of sailings and the number of people riding the system, that we won't generate that amount of revenue even by increasing the 4.5%. It's not necessarily that people will turn away. It's just we're not going to have the same volume of people riding if we're not running the same schedule.
Thank you. Through the Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So you're talking about a panel that lives on the road system. We can drive almost anywhere we want. And obviously the Marine Highway connects communities that don't have a contiguous road system. Let me ask you about another savings potential. Would you be able to present to us a budget savings of a reasonable curtailment in road resurfacing frequency so that we could save money that way? Obviously, everybody's going to have to be inconvenienced, and you have to decide whether it's going to be seniors, kids, drivers, somebody. But is there a reasonable way to cut back on resurfacing frequency on the road system that you could present to us to save money?
Sure, Representative Pierre. I believe our department is looking at multiple initiatives to find ways to reduce our costs across our system, not just in the marine highways or with roads or aviation, but across the system. Both, and again, just like the marine highway system, you know, it's the two-sided piece, reducing costs and looking at additional revenue opportunities.
Okay, thank you, members. I think it's been a good discussion today. It's a good start on where we're going tomorrow. We're going to start out with the public education funding formula, so that should be a good discussion. We do have Representative Vasquez in the audience, too. Welcome, Liz. Tomorrow, we will start out at 1:30 to 3:30. So that's our agenda for today. And thank you, members. We will adjourn for the day.